You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Bike Radar podcast, brought to you by the team behind BikeRadar.com, Cycling Plus and MBUK magazines. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe. And if you can do so, leave us a rating on your podcast provider of choice. It really helps us reach other cyclists like you. Hello, welcome to the Bike Radar podcast. My name is Tom Marvin, Senior Technical Editor here at BikeRadar.com and at MBUK Magazine as well. Joining me on this episode of the podcast are two of our tech titans from the world of mountain biking and road cycling. First up, we've got Al Evans up in Scotland. He's our Senior Technical Editor for Bike Radar. How's it going, Al?
Yeah, great. Thank you, Tom. Absolutely brilliant.
Excellent stuff. You sound very convincing there. And in the studio today, we have Warren Roster. He's our Senior Technical Editor for all things road and gravel. How's it going, Warren?
Very good, thanks, mate.
It has been a disgusting month. I was watching Countryfile last night, which obviously a big fan of.
So middle class.
I think they mentioned that like South Wales, which is very close to where myself and Warren are, had something like 270% more rain than expected in the month of February, which makes for very muddy testing of mountain bikes and pretty grim on the road as well.
Well, I mean, it's a weird thing. At the minute, I'm testing endurance road bikes, gravel bikes, and a bunch of kind of urban, suburban e-bikes. And by far, I feel the safest riding at the minute are the gravel bikes.
Yeah.
Because the roads are so bad. They've been so destroyed by all this rain. Mm. I mean, literally, I rode in this morning, and there's a section of tarmac going through one of the villages near me that has only got resurfaced last summer. And where there's so much rain, it's got underneath the resurfacing and lifted it. Huh. About 100 meter section where it looks like there's been an earthquake.
Wow.
I mean, to the point where they closed the road, but you know, I got to the road closed bit and I could see the other side of it. So I'm going through it, didn't matter. Yeah. But you couldn't drive a car through it.
No.
And that's only just been done. And it's absolutely, and you know, the roads have been destroyed by this amount of water.
Yeah. The roads have been destroyed and my washing machine has been destroyed by almost daily washing a very, very muddy kit. Absolutely grim. Is it any better up in the sort of the southeast of Scotland, Al?
Well, it's a little bit drier actually, which is quite a treat. I think we've kind of all the rain kind of falls on the west side of the UK and then misses us on the east. But the roads are also terrible. I think the locals say in the rest of the UK you drive on the left hand side of the road. In the Scottish borders you drive on what's left of the road. So I think maybe we could expand that to the rest of the UK now, judging by Warren's local roads.
Yeah, I think even driving to the Forest of Dean, you're constantly dodging potholes and all sorts in the car. I've definitely slammed my suspension through a few unseen puddled potholes in recent weeks. fun and games. All right, well, now we've discussed the state of the roads in Britain and trails, we'll move on to the actual topic of today's podcast, which, if you've read the description or the title, you'll know is one of our tech Q&As. So in this episode, we have five questions sent in by our wonderful listeners who have emailed podcast@bikeradar.com with their tech questions. And Warren and Al are going to go through them and hopefully pass on some pearls of wisdom. Right, we'll start with the first question in my list, which is one predominantly for Al, but of course, Warren, feel free to chip in if you've got anything relevant to say. I've got a £1,000 budget for a new mountain bike. It's my first proper bike coming from a rigid hybrid that I've been riding around the forest some. I've seen a Trek Roscoe 7 from 2024 and an Orbea Laufey H30 from 2023 within my budget. Which would you suggest? Al, have you got any thoughts on those two bikes? They're both kind of like traily hardtails.
They are, yeah. And they've both been updated fairly recently, I believe. I believe that these are the latest models that are currently on sale. So I'd say definitely at this price point, you're absolutely right to be looking for a hardtail. You know, they'd be 100% offering your best bang for buck compared to a full suspension. So on full suspension bikes at this price range, you'll find that, you know, they have to spend extra money on pivot bearings, suspension linkages, more complicated tubing, and that money is taken away from the bike's specs. So, you know, while you might get a rear suspension system, you're not necessarily going to get a better spec bike. So a hardtail, 100%, you're already on the right track. Now, I've had to kind of modify your question a little bit. I've had to up the budget to 1,500 because I noticed that the Orbea has actually increased in price maybe since you last looked. There are loads of deals to be had at the moment, so you might be able to find one for closer to £1,000. But I've done 1,000 to 1,500. So, you know, it's the right kind of ballpark. So what do you get for this sort of price range? Well, you get dropper posts, you get 12-speed drivetrains, you know, more sophisticated fork than even cheaper bikes. With these two bikes, they're actually kind of level pegging on so many different fronts. They've both got Shimano's 12-speed M6100 drivetrain. Now, this is actually a really important thing because it uses the same technology as the more expensive ranges in Shimano's drivetrain series. So, you know, you've got the microspline cassette technology, which is shared with XTR. So should you ever wish to upgrade later down the line, you can just swap out the cassettes rather than having to swap out free hubs, potentially wheels, loads of other bits. They've both also got RockShox's Recon fork, both with 140 millimeters of travel, except for on Trek's extra small frame size, which actually has 120 mil travel fork, so to make it proportional to the rest of the bike's geometry. So once again, you know, they're kind of level pegging in the fork front, the drivetrain front. And then it's kind of the same story with all of their kind of components. These are from own brand parts. So you've got Trek's Bontrager and Orbea's OC parts, which is their house brand. So that's bar stem, saddle, grips, et cetera, et cetera. And at this price point, there's not going to be a huge difference between, you know, the two components there. They're going to be much for muchness. Onto the seat post. Now, Trek's got a Trans X dropper post fitted and Orbea sticks with their own brand componentry. Once again, you know, TransX, it's not your RockShox or your Fox. It is a more budget brand. So, you know, don't look too much into the brand name. I think the Orbea post is going to be, you know, just as good. So we're still level pegging. But you then look at their geometry and things begin to diverge a little bit. So this might actually help you make a decision because so far you're kind of much for muchness. The Trek's actually got a 6-size range compared to Orbea's 4. So if you're at the extreme ends of the geometry bell curve, or if you're particularly fussy about the type of geometry that you like, the Trek's certainly got more options. The Orbea actually comes out bigger at the top end. So the Orbea's largest bike is larger than Trek's, but the small is considerably smaller on the Trek range compared to the Orbea. So, you know, that's maybe one thing to consider. Obviously, in your question, I don't know how tall you are, but that could be quite, an important factor. Sticking with the geometry, Orbea's head tube is actually slacker in any given size, and the seat tube angle is steeper. So what this means is that on the downhills, it could handle in a slightly more calmed, composed way, depending on, you know, how gnarly, fast, etc. you're wanting to be going. And on the uphills, because of the steeper seat tube angle, it will place your hips more directly over the bottom bracket, potentially making climbing more efficient and comfortable. In this respect, Trek's geometry is more conservative. It's not old school. You know, it's certainly a modern looking trail bike shape. But that slightly more conservative figure could make it feel marginally more familiar to you, more comparable to your current bike, but only slightly. You know, once again, there's not a huge amount in it, even though the differences are there. Onto the price. So I could find these bikes online just before we had this conversation. The Orbea that I found was £1,599 and the Trek is £1,200. That's quite a chunk less for what's ostensibly probably going to deliver almost identical performance out on the trails. The Orbea certainly has a more radder look to it. It, you know, it's potentially got a slightly more extreme looking shape, maybe slightly nicer looking if you like the same things that I do. One big thing that it does have, and that's down tube frame storage. You know, that was actually, you know, that might be quite a big thing for you. So what that means is there's a port in the down tube and you can put things in there to store. So you don't have to have them in your bum bag, in your backpack, attached to the frame. But to be completely honest with you, you're going to struggle to go wrong with either of these bikes. I think that, you know, it's going to come down to personal preference. And the biggest thing that I could recommend is that you try and find a demo day or go to your local Orbea or Trek dealer and actually see these bikes in the flesh. You know, it's all well and good lusting over them on the internet and looking at pictures. But if you can see them in real life, actually compare their finishes, and, you know, there might be one particular thing on one of them that really sparkles and shines for you.
Great. Lovely stuff. Well, yeah, I think I'll probably echo that. I think one of the things I had noticed was, I think the 23 version of the Laufey had like 2.6 inch rubber, and I think for 24 they went down to 2.4.
Okay.
So that might be sort of where some of that price thing's coming in as well. If you found a particularly good deal on that 23 bike, I don't think it, you know, if it's your first mountain bike, having a 2.6 inch recon on the back and whatever it was on the front, that's probably no bad thing. A bit of extra comfort and grip potentially.
Yeah, absolutely, especially at lower pressures.
Yeah. Lovely stuff. Okay. Right. Well, we'll move on to our first road bike question, and it is replacing my bar tape a dark art, or is it much simpler than many of the guides out there would have you believe? What kind of tape is best for road riding, and do I need to think about tape thickness or those gel inserts? Or am I overthinking it? I've recently retaped a handlebar, and I think it's a dark art because I've done a terrible job.
I mean, bar taping is one of those things that feels like it's a dark art until you actually do it a few times. There are some really good how-to vids out there over on YouTube, and there's even one from Bike Radar that's pretty good. The one thing I would always say when you're taping your bars is just think about how the tape goes on. So on the left-hand side, tape clockwise. And on the right-hand side, tape anti-clockwise, because right. That means when you're gripping the bars, you're actually tightening the tape rather than loosening it. That's a simple kind of first thing to sort of remember while you're doing it.
I never knew that. That's revolutionised my bar taping procedure already.
As for inserts, widths, thicknesses, etc., most of that's just personal preference. You know, I'd say EVA foam tapes, which tend to be at the budget end of things, are absolutely fine. Though they do wear quicker than the more expensive polyurethane EVA kind of combination tapes. Foam-baked tapes, they also offer less grip in the wet, and they can actually sort of wet out in prolonged rain. And you also need to be really careful with an EVA tape that you don't overstretch it.
Okay.
You can overstretch it, and then it basically wears a lot quicker, and it's not particularly comfortable. I'd say opt for a really good like PU-coated tape, something like, I've just done a load of bar tapes actually for Bike Radar, so of those ones, I'd say Prologo's Easy Touch, Supercast, Sticky Cush, or the classic Lizard Skins DSP, where you've got some pricier options, Silka's Nastro Piloti.
Sounds fancy.
It's very nice. And they all have like really good shock absorbency. And they actually sort of get tacky in the wet, so they give you really excellent grip. Notice I'm just talking about riding in the wet, because that's all I'm doing at the minute. Though I would say with a PU tape, is just make sure you wash your tape properly post a sweaty ride. Seriously, with like soapy water, because the PU and the salt water aren't really a great mix. And if you leave your bike for a week or two and you've left the bar tape sweaty, you'll come back and it will go sort of white and crusty. And it can even develop like a bit of mold. And there's no way you want to be putting your hands on something that's got a bit of mold in it and then wiping your face or your nose or whatever. You know, leather tapes or classic rigid sort of no stretch tapes should only be used on like resto classic bikes or show bikes, as they have little or no stretch. And leather tapes, whilst looking really good and aging well, don't offer much in the way of cushioning, and over time can compress, especially where you hold the bars the most.
Okay.
Personally, I really like a thicker tape, as I've got, you know, big hands, but I'm also a fan of tapes that have minimal adhesive. So that's the sticky back, I mean, basically, or even in some cases, none at all. My gravel bike, I've been using Wolftooth Massive. It's like 55 millimeter wide, 5 millimeter thick supple tape, which has absolutely no adhesive on it at all. It relies on the sort of natural tackiness of the material to wrap and get a really nice fit. But it also means once you've been out and you've got your bike absolutely caked and everything, you can take the tape off and wash it. Like literally put it in a bucket and wash it. Dry it properly, put it back on. Though I would recommend with that getting the expander plugs, you know, the Allen key expander plugs, rather than use them silly. I mean, I wouldn't say that's the first thing I do. Plastic plugs in the end of your bars, just bin them.
Okay.
Yeah, they're dreadful. They wear, they fall out. You know, you only have to lean your bike up against a wall and you get home and go, oh, it's gone. That's gone. So, you know, they add a little bit of weight with the, you know, the expander wedge, but it just works so much better. I mean, in tapes like Supercars and Silka, they have them as standard. So that's worth noting, even though they're a little bit more expensive, you do get that.
You get the bung.
You get that bung significant upgrade. And I think it's probably worth it.
When it comes to, so the thing I always struggle with, that makes it sound like I take my bars regularly. The times I've taped my bars on a couple of occasions, the area around the brake levers, right? There seems to be two options. You can do sort of some sort of weird figure of eight thing,
yeah,
and you sort of make it look neat like that, or you snip a bit off the end, or you get a bit off the end sort of provided, and you wrap that around the bar clamp, and then you can make it look tidier. Like, what do you go for?
I normally do the up, over, back under, and over, but that's only because those little offcuts that you normally get, I tend to lose them.
Yeah.
Although on the bar tapes I just did, I think it was the Silka one. They don't just give you a little offcut. They give you like a thing that's like bow tie shaped.
Okay.
And that fits around the clamp perfectly. It's a really nice idea, you know. So again, it's sort of what you're used to, really.
Yeah.
I mean, and obviously with that Wolfsuit one, which comes off and on, you know, you can't cut a bit off and stick it in there, because it'll just fall out. So it's the up, over, under, back, around way of doing it is kind of, I mean, that tends to come from when you see bikes assembled in the factory.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to tape that way because it's a quicker operation than cutting a bit, sticking it in, blah, blah, blah. You know, so that's, you know, when mass assembly, it tends to get done that way.
Okay. And presumably the people who are mass assembling it do it all the time, so they're very good at
doing it. Yeah.
I guess there's no robot yet.
No, not yet. But the other thing is, I mean, some people can be so overwhelmingly anal about bar taping. And one of my mates, who I always used to get build bikes for me, he's a bit OCD, you know, fabulous, you know, engineer and bike mechanic. Whenever I used to get bar tape on my bikes, he used vernier gauges so that every wrap was exactly the same length. And he was so OCD that if he got to the end and one wasn't, you know, a couple of millimeters out, he'd unwind it and do it again. Those spaces had to be exact. So you can go over the top.
Yeah. Okay.
I've got two questions about this. Warren, which end do you start at? Do you start at the stem end or the end of the curly bit? And then if you start at the end of the curly bit, when you finish at the stem end, what do you use to finish it off with?
I always start at the end of the bar, at the end of the curly bit, as you technically put it. And then when you get up to where you want to finish it, the idea is to actually get that kind of last wrap, and then you want to be basically cutting the end straight so it matches where the end of the tape ends, so it all fits flush. And then just use a bit of electrical tape, or there's a couple of brands out there that actually do kind of an elastomer ring, which you can then slide over, and that finishes off really nicely.
Nice. Interesting. So not sellotape?
No, definitely not sellotape. You want something that's going to be weatherproof.
Bit of duct tape, maybe.
Yeah. Gaffer tape will be all right, yeah.
Never get them off. All right, lovely stuff. Well, as I said, I still think it's a bit of a dark art, but do head over to bikeradar.com for what will be your reviews going up soon, I presume, and search on Bike Radar's excellent YouTube channel for a guide on how to tape your bars, which apparently is a really good guide.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
The world isn't wide enough. Get immersed in the expansive views of the 48-inch customizable panoramic display in the all-new 2024 Lincoln Nautilus Hybrid. Explore more at Lincoln.com. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates.
All right, we're going to move on to a more general question, which is open to the both of you. Is a proper work stand a must-have for maintaining my bike these days? Can I get away with one which just stands the bike up by the back wheel, or should I really get one that holds the bike by the seat post? Do you get what you pay for in terms of the more expensive models? I'll go to you, Warren, on this first.
I mean, I'd say it's dependent on your bike or bikes. You know, if, for example, you just have like a reasonably light road bike, then a standard budget stand will suffice. You know, something like the budget offering from Decathlon or Lifeline, or step up to one of the keener price Toe Peaks like the Prep Stand, or Feedback do one called the Recreation. They're all really good. Or you can just get a stand, either one that's rear wheel, you know, lifts the rear wheel, or under the BB. Personally, that means a lot of bending down if you want to work on your drivetrain, for example. But I would say if you're short on space, but you're organized, then a wall mounting stand's really good. I mean, I've got one in one of my garages from Lifeline, which just bolts to the wall. And so it's like the jaws of a pro stand, but it's only like a foot long and it folds flat against the wall. And that's really handy. And it's also good for bike storage. And a good thing is also because it's mounted to a wall, and if you've mounted the wall properly, it can take a fair bit of weight. So you can actually even put like an e-bike on it.
Okay.
But for heavier bikes like e-bikes, you know, your stand's got to be pretty substantial. I mean, Al can probably talk more to that because it's on the mountain bike side of things. But most stands do have a max capacity. You know, something like the Feedback Pro Mechanic can take like 45 kilos, which should cover off most substantial e-bikes and e-mountain bikes. Personally, I really like a fork clamping stand. Toe Peak do one called the Prep Stand X, and Lifeline do the Pro Fork Mount. And both of those, you basically take the front wheel out, clamp the fork in, but then it's suspended. It literally holds the bike under the bottom bracket shell, which frees your drivetrain up. And so you can spin your cranks. So it's great for cleaning your chain. It's great for making gear adjustments. And also both of those two, they have a central tripod in the middle, and so the bike spins.
Ah.
So if you're, again, if you're short on space and it's difficult for you to walk around your stand, you can literally spin the bike around whilst you're there. Super fast, super convenient. You can spend an awful lot on a top-end stand, but I think as long as you get a stand that's stable, secure, fits where you want to use it, then you don't need to pay a huge amount. You tend to find on the top-end stands, you just get more attachments. You get like tool trays and, you know, all these kind of extra bits, which, to be honest, I can live without most of those, though I couldn't really live without a work stand.
Yeah. Okay. Al, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think just to, you know, I'm definitely going to echo what Warren says. The only thing I'd say is maybe try and spend as much as you humanly can. If you can spend more, obviously do. I guess the way to justify it would be to look at the lifespan of a stand. You know, if you're choosing one with sturdier metal fastenings instead of plastic ones, it's likely to last much longer in the long run. And you could potentially justify the extra expense by spreading that over the number of years that you're going to own it. I know I did that with my trusty PCS9, which is now coming up to nearly 15 years old, that thing, and it gets used very regularly. Still absolutely fine. That's a park tool one. So, you know, I think that would be definitely one thing that I would maybe say. And the other thing is to consider what material your bike is made out of. You know, if you've got a carbon fiber bike, you definitely don't want to be mounting the tubes without, you know, an additional add-on. I think you can get these for bike stands as well as bike racks, where there's an extra bar that spans the seat tube and the stem / handlebars, and you can clamp the bike on there if you don't want to clamp it using the seat tube. But just, you know, just be super mindful, super careful that the jaws of a bike stand can easily crush your bike's tubes, especially if they're carbon fiber.
Great. I think like you, I've had my bike stand for a very long time. I'd actually keep wanting a new one because mine's actually not that stable, but life's too short. Life's too short to fix bikes.
You just chuck them away, don't you?
A little bit maintenance phobic.
Spoke broken in the bin.
All right, well, we'll move on to our next question, which is one for Al. What would you suggest the base settings for my new forks be? They're Fox 38 Performance Elite with Grip 2 damper, so that has high and low speed compression and damping twiddly bits. I added the twiddly bits in, but you know what I mean. I weigh 75 kilos kitted up. I've seen various reference to X number of clicks from closed or fully open. It's on a bike I've purchased but hasn't yet arrived, so I want to hit the ground running with the setup. I guess sort of to expand on that, you know, all these sort of, we talk about clicks all the time, you know, running suspension fast or X clicks from closed, as I said, or fully open, all this sort of stuff. It can be a little bit maybe confusing if previously maybe you've had a simpler fork with like a lockout on the top and a rebound dial on the bottom with a, you know, a tortoise and a hare on there to sort of dictate whether it's fast or slow. But do you want to sort of a little bit delve into what all that means and then maybe help with some setup settings?
Yeah, absolutely. I think maybe definitely open this with do not necessarily copy other people's settings. And without loads of additional information, such as the bike, the travel, the trails you ride, your riding style, your ability, et cetera, it's really tricky to recommend a specific setup. So I think the simplest answer is probably start with the brand's recommendations for your weight. On the Fox Forks, this is on a sticker down by the rebound adjuster on the back of the lower legs. And that's got fork pressure and rebound settings on there. And you know, that those will give you a great starting point. So basically what you need to do is you need to start with your spring pressure, set that to the recommended pressure, and then adjust according to feel and how much sag you have. If there's too little sag, make it softer. If there's too much, make it harder. Like you said, the rebound adjustment, this is usually stated as number of clicks from either fully open or fully closed. On the Fox Forks, it's number of clicks of adjustment out from fully closed. So the way to think about this is close your rebound adjusters. So turn them fully clockwise all the way until they stop. Don't force them. The stops, you know, it's not particularly hard, but it is definitely pronounced. So turn that until it stops and then back it off. So open it anti-clockwise by the number of clicks that Fox suggests. It's the same with the compression damper. They have their recommend settings on the website. So the rebound settings are done by spring pressure. So the more inflated your spring is, the more rebound damping you're going to need to have. So the slower in inverted commas, your forks need to be set. But because of the spring pressure, they're likely to rebound at a similar speed throughout their rebound setting range. That's why Fox have different settings for different spring pressures. On the compression damper, they actually recommend settings for all spring pressures. So they say to start with the high speed compression 5 clicks out from fully closed and the low speed compression 10 clicks out from fully closed. Now you've got your base settings. You need to go out on the trail. You know, hopefully what you need to be doing is riding the same run in the same conditions back to back. And what you're going to look to do is make small adjustments. So for example, if your forks aren't absorbing bumps well, or they're not returning to their full travel quick enough, which is something called packing down, you'll notice that the front end of your bike will feel super low, you won't have much grip, won't be particularly smooth. Try opening the damper adjustments, but only do them one at a time and in really small increments. Don't do all of the rebound and all of the compression at once, because they can interact with one another and you won't know which one is having an effect. So one setting could be right and the other could be wrong, but you've adjusted both and now they're both wrong. Always make a note of your base settings and what adjustments you've made. That's super important, so that if the bike begins to feel bad, you can actually put it back to how it was and start again. And, you know, it may be that you end up with all of the adjustments fully open. In this case, it could be that your spring is actually too hard. Although I'm not wanting to put a spanner in the works, it could also mean that the forks are overdamped for your riding style, the tracks you ride, or your weight. Personally, I weigh 75 kilos as well. I actually run all of the high and low speed rebound and high speed compression adjusters on the Grip 2 damper that you've got on your new forks fully open. I only run, you know, 2 to 4 clicks of low speed compression dampening on them. And quite a few of us on Bike Radar have commented on a similar thing on the Grip 2 damper. So, you know, the best thing you can do is experiment, be methodical, logical, and, you know, try and really get into tune with what your bike's feeling. So in short, follow the recommendations, make small adjustments, record all of your settings and the changes, and certainly do not copy what someone else is saying, because they may have got it wrong as well.
And everyone's different. I guess it gives you an excuse to go out and just do a bit of sessioning, really, which is something that many riders don't do enough of. So keep doing the same track over and over. Not only will you improve your lines, but you'll get your suspension set up well as well.
Absolutely. And it's great fun.
Yeah. Can be great fun if the weather's nice. And yeah.
Yes. It's not raining.
And you've got some nice snacks and, you know, maybe snacks. A cup of tea at the bottom and all the good stuff. All right. Lovely. Well, we'll move on to our final question for this podcast. And it is, I've just moved to a new area and I'm looking at joining my local road club. They stipulate mud guards and rear lights for their club rides, which seems fair. I've got a Trek Amanda from 2022, which doesn't have eyelets. Can you suggest a decent clip-on mud guard and perhaps your go-to rear light?
Right. For clip-on guards, there are some good value options out there. There's the Flinger Race Pro set, which is really good value, but it does rely on having a bridge and a drilled fork crown, which I'm not sure if the 22 Amondo has. If it does, all good. But that's a really good option for a bike with rim brakes. For disc brakes, then the classic SKS race blade is the most popular option, though SKS have a more recent one called the Veloflex, which has a bit of a longer blade at the rear, so it's probably a better option for group riding. I would say that when it comes to spring and you're taking these mud guards off, the one piece of advice I'll give is take all those fixtures and fittings, put them in a Ziploc bag and put them somewhere safe. Because bitter experience has shown me many times when I get to the autumn mode, get those out and I can't find the fittings. It just has me like cursing the world. Mm-hmm. And personally, I really like Assaver's Wingman 2. It's really, really good, fast fitting, broad spectrum. And I'm using that on both my road and my gravel bike. I'm not sure how much protection that offers a rider following you, because it's...
So that's the whole point of using a mud guard in a group ride, is it's not just for your backside, it's for someone else.
So you're not spraying the person following your wheel, right? You know, just like coating them in road grime. Mm-hmm. As for rear light, we've got masses of those reviewed on Bike Radar, including a lot of new fresh ones. Myself, I'm not that much of a fan of flashing light modes. I think whilst they're visible, they can be really off-putting to a driver following you, especially in light. Really poor conditions where it can just be such a massive distraction. So I tend to opt for a rear light that's got a solid, you know, just a solid pattern. And to be honest, I just pull out a good old Nog blinder, which I've had.
Do you like the Nog ones?
I've had a Nog blinder for about 10 years and it's never gone wrong. It recharges all the time, it's data sealed. So that's absolutely fine. Although, if it's like my more of a kind of ride into a city, say if I'm riding to the office or whatever, I do break out a Garmin Varia. Basically for the radar, and I never needed the camera, but it's probably nice to know it's there.
And there's reviews of that online as well, the Varia radar thing. Yeah, it's quite, you need a head unit with it and it just beeps at you when a car comes behind you.
Yeah, literally, yeah. I mean, it does come with just like a bar mount, so even if you're not running a GPS, it just has like a series of lights and it makes an audible noise. But if you're actually running it with a head unit, it's immense, because you get a graphic of a car and how far it is behind you and how close it's getting to you. So you're not constantly have to look over your shoulder, especially when you're, you know, when it's turn across traffic to turn right or whatever.
Yeah.
It's a really nice extra safety feature.
Okay.
And it's a really good light with it as well.
And in winter, are you riding with a mud guard all the time anyway, regardless of whether you're in a group or solo?
Tend to, yeah. Yeah. It just, you know, it keeps your kit cleaner. You know, it extends the longevity of your winter tights and your jackets, because you're not spraying grimy diesel and mud all the way up your back. So.
Okay.
You know, and it's less hassle on your washing machine as well.
Yeah, happy days. Maybe we should start putting mud guards on the mountain bikes, I reckon, Al.
I'm an advocate. I say that everyone should be wearing them and ignoring the fact that they don't look very good. They're incredible. Harriet and I frequently go out and she's got a mud guard on her e-bike. She comes back clean and I am absolutely caked.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the whole argument of it doesn't really look cool. I'm down with that. I used to be exactly that person. But then I think it actually looks a bit cooler than looking as if you when you get off bike looking like you've messed yourself.
That's very true, yeah. Maybe I'll try and get hold of a nice big rear mud guard for my bike of the year testing.
They're beautiful, beautiful things.
We'll see. Okay, guys, well, thanks ever so much for all your contributions. Of course, if you've got your own questions for future tech Q&A, you can email us podcast@bikeradar.com. And if you've got any questions or comments or suggestions for the podcast, that's the email address as well. And don't forget, of course, please leave us a rating on your podcast provider of choice. Thanks ever so much, Al, and thank you, Warren. We'll be back with another podcast very soon. Thanks for listening to the Bike Radar podcast. If you've not done so already, please subscribe and share with your friends, or leave us a rating if you've enjoyed this episode.